The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm going to briefly introduce our panelists whose biographies you have in your materials. And let me introduce first, even though he's not going to speak first, someone who is a surprise to most of you today. Lisa Monaco, who is the new Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division at the Justice Department, got summoned to a White House meeting at the same time as this panel late yesterday. And so we have a terrific replacement for Lisa, her alter ego, John Carlin, who is the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division and the Chief of Staff for the National Security Division. He had a similar job until recently as Chief of Staff for Bob Mueller, the Director of the FBI, who I guess is going to continue as Director of the FBI for two more years in this unique 12-year term. I think, John, this new job should be pretty easy for you because the National Security Division is much smaller than the FBI. So if you could run the FBI, you can run the National Security Division. John is a career lawyer at the Justice Department. He started out in the honors program at the Tax Division, prosecuting tax cheats, and then moved on to be an assistant U.S. attorney before going to the FBI. Next to John is Ivan Fong, who was a colleague of mine in the Clinton-Reno Justice Department. It seems like ages ago. Ivan was a deputy associate attorney general at the Justice Department when I was there. Ivan, we have two presidents of law reviews here today. Ivan was the president of the Stanford Law Review and then was a law clerk for Judge Mikva on the D.C. Circuit and for Justice O'Connor. Then he went to Covington and Burling, then he went to the Justice Department, and then he went to GE, where he was a senior lawyer and then was the chief legal officer at Cardinal Health before coming back to Washington, where he belongs, to be the general counsel of the vast and sprawling Department of Homeland Security. I won't spend much time on our other two panelists because they're very well known in this building. They are two of our distinguished professors who teach and write prolifically in the national security law area. Ken Anderson, I guess I'm a late-in-life academic. Ken is a mid-career academic, and Steve Vladek is a young academic. Ken Anderson teaches international law and business law courses here and writes extensively on issues relating to the law of war and national security law. He's a fellow at the Hoover Institution and at the Brookings Institution, so he's got both ends covered. Steve Vladek teaches constitutional law, federal courts, and national security law here. He was a law clerk for Judge Berzon on the Ninth Circuit and Judge Barquette on the 11th Circuit, and is also a prolific writer in these fields. Okay, with that introduction, I think we're going to start with Ivan. And we'll have time for questions when the panel is finished.
Thank you very much, Dan. If it's okay, I'll sit with the panel because I hope that this will be truly a panel and not a series of speeches and that we can have some dialogue among the panel and obviously with the audience. First, I want to thank again Dan, but also the American University Washington College of Law for hosting this program. It's a real privilege to be here. Dan and I, as he indicated, have known each other for a long time, and in fact, every day when I walk into my office, I have a plaque that I got when I left the Department of Justice, and Dan was the acting associate attorney general at the time, and so his name and his signature greets me every morning. I also want to thank the other panelists for being here. I think this is both a timely and an important topic for us to talk about, which is combating the ever-changing terrorist threat, legal and policy issues. What I thought I would do in my sort of 10 minutes to start is really to set the stage in a way similar to the way Mike Leiter did. But I'm going to take a slightly different approach. I'll start first with my bottom line, up front, which is that in terms of the changes that have occurred in the legal and policy realm in this area, I think a lot has changed. I think the United States has made significant progress in securing the homeland from terrorism since the 9/11 attacks. But that said, much work remains. The threats persist and continue to evolve. And I think that's my jumping off point, which is how do we as a country, how do our legal institutions, how do the people who are on the front lines and the policymakers adapt to an evolving threat? And my basic proposition, and this is, I think, appropriate for a law school audience, is that it's not so much about changes in the law per se. So I think we all are familiar with things like the Patriot Act, the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act, which created the Director of National Intelligence and the NCTC, the Detainee Treatment Act, the Military Commissions Act. There have been a lot of laws, including the law that created the Department of Homeland Security. But to me, it's really the institutions and processes that have made the difference and that are the key to our continuing effort to adapt. So let me unpack a little bit what I mean by that. So we're starting with institutions. I think the most significant change, and it's the one I'm the most familiar with, is the creation of an entirely new cabinet department. So 10 years ago, DHS did not exist. In 2003, it stood up, bringing together 22 different federal agencies. It is now formed as about seven operating components. So I always get asked, you know, what does DHS do? I think to this day there are still people who don't quite understand or know how they all fit together. So if you remember nothing else, remember these seven agencies. So it's the three former Immigration and Naturalization Service agencies, so what was formerly INS, so ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and CIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services. They do the immigration benefits, the visas, the asylum applications, and the like, plus FEMA, Coast Guard, TSA, and Secret Service. And so when you think about the breadth and the complexity of those agencies and the overarching missions, and so just to recap again, DHS's missions, obviously it's the preventing and combating terrorism, which is the cornerstone mission, but also securing and administering the border, administering and enforcing our immigration laws, securing cyberspace, which I'll talk a little bit more about later, and something that I think is a relatively new concept, but which I think is as important as the offense and defense and long game that Mike Leiter referred to, and that is to promote and ensure resiliency in response to disasters of all kinds. And again, it's something I'll come back to. What about processes and procedures? To me, the most significant changes have come in the area of information sharing. So you'll recall that one of the significant findings of the 9/11 Commission was the stovepiped nature of the intelligence community, the law enforcement community, the first responder community, state and locals. We have made really, I think, dramatic improvements in not just the actual sharing of information, but the culture in which those actors engage. And to me, it's very significant, for example, that DHS has 72 fusion centers. These are centers where federal, state, local law enforcement come together to share intelligence information. The Suspicious Activity Report initiative to standardize how state and local law enforcement collect and share information. The new National Terrorism Alert System, so you recall the old color-coded system, has now been replaced by a much, we think, better system that is much more specific, more concrete in the form of what is the threat, what actions people can take, and most importantly, has an automatic sunset provision so that we are not constantly under some very high state of alert. The Secretary of Homeland Security is fond of saying that homeland security begins with hometown security, and that means that in terms of information sharing, we all play a role. You've probably seen signs across Amtrak or elsewhere that talk about if you see something, say something. If you look at the plots here in the U.S. that have been disrupted, most of them have involved some member of the public who alerted somebody in law enforcement. And I could go on. The international efforts at sharing information and formalizing those relationships have been significant as well. So to me, that is a huge change and a huge improvement. A second area, we're all familiar with aviation security. I think a lot of the changes occur behind the scenes. A lot of them have to do with the screening of passenger identities before people board the plane, establishing global aviation security standards, increasing security at our ports, as well as surface transportation, using risk-based methods to do a better job of screening and identifying potential threats, making better use of watch lists and more intelligent use to avoid overextending in that area. And you may have read about plans to increase the Trusted Traveler program, which would again be more risk-based as opposed to one size fits all. The last thing I'll say before I identify the sort of handful of legal issues that I see down the road has to do with cyber security. It's I think the area that I one of the areas that I'm most concerned about, in part because it is so new, it presents many difficult legal and policy issues, and because I think we are probably more vulnerable in this area than we should be. DHS has done a lot. We have rolled out a cyber intrusion detection system for the .gov domain, so DHS's role is to protect government networks. We have stood up a National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center that integrates threat information and shares it and distributes it. We have entered into groundbreaking agreements with the Defense Department to share personnel, information, resources so that we can be truly partners in this effort. We have also established a cyber incident response plan. We have conducted exercises. And so there are a lot of things that we are doing, but as I said, it's an area that remains a challenge for us in the government. The issues, I'll start with the obvious, I think, the overarching theme of the program, evolving threats. I mentioned cyber. I would add to that something that Mike Leiter mentioned, which is the issue of homegrown violent extremists and how to address that threat. Soft targets and the use of improvised explosive devices. So very small scale attacks that require very little planning, don't provide much advance notice. And so to the extent we have better intelligence, we have better capabilities, those really are directed toward the larger scale plots that take often years to develop. It's the smaller ones that can cause just as much psychological harm that I think is something that we need to continue to adapt to. And that leads me to the point that I mentioned earlier about resilience and something that Mike Leiter mentioned, and that is the extent to which we as a society have to be prepared that we're not going to be perfect, that we cannot guarantee 100% security, and that given enough time, any system is going to have some failure, and that we need to prepare ourselves for some kind of attack or incident, not something we want. We will do everything possible to prevent, but we as a country need to be resilient. We need to bounce back. We need to go on. We need to continue to do the things we are doing rather than let an incident really bring us down as a country. And so I think that's a long-term, very important goal that requires a lot of work. Other legal issues, I mentioned earlier a focus on prevention, and I think prevention is very different from our traditional law enforcement approach, which is, you know, a crime or some wrongdoing occurs, and we have well-established procedures and capabilities for responding. Preventing is and can be more difficult, and one aspect that DHS is part of, and I'm sure we'll hear about others from the FBI and DOJ side, is the concept of pushing out our borders, that the borders, the physical borders, actually ought to be a last line of defense, not a first line of defense. And so some of the work that we've done in cooperation with our foreign partners to ensure better visa screening, to get more intelligence, all is about this concept of pushing our borders out. And that, of course, raises legal questions about extraterritorial applicability, about the rights of non-U.S. citizens and U.S. citizens who are abroad, and the importance of partnership agreements. The third major issue, of course, is privacy and civil rights and civil liberties. I think it is an area that not only we, the lawyers, but the department as a whole is deeply committed to protecting. We have a statutorily created, dedicated office for privacy and separately for civil rights and civil liberties. Those individuals, as well as my office, are involved in all major decisions, and we have very full, robust, frank conversations about how proposed courses of action may affect privacy and civil liberties, civil rights, and they're very much taken into account in the decision-making process. Last couple ones, I'll mention the role of the private sector. We haven't talked much about that so far. Much of our infrastructure is in the hands of the private sector, certainly our cyber infrastructure, but also chemical facilities, the electric grid, the water supply, our financial institutions. And so we at DHS have as really one of our important missions the outreach and the coordination with the private sector. And in turn, our message to the private sector, which is you have to be prepared. It has to be a core competence that you respond, you prevent, just in the same way the government does today. And so that's a significant change as well. It raises legal issues going forward about crisis response plans, doing exercises and drills. It's elevated to the chief executive officer, chief risk officer, board of director level. So it is a significant issue for the private sector. And then I'll close with a note that may be closer to home, and that is to talk about the future. And the way we adapt is by having great talent. And one of the things that I have talked as I go around speaking on this topic is the need for law students such as you and law schools such as WCL to really promote and invest in a Homeland Security law curriculum. It's something that can start with very basic courses in constitutional law, administrative law, international law, and then building block courses in areas that are more specialized in homeland security, such as maritime law, maybe even aviation security law or cyber security law, national security law. And then I would envision a capstone course called Homeland Security Law. And we actually piloted for our lawyers, our new lawyers, a course on Homeland Security Law. And so every lawyer who comes to DHS within their first year, year and a half, will go through a week-long session or seminar that will introduce them to all the different parts, not only what DHS does, but some basic legal issue spotting sessions to help them see the integration of how the pieces fit together. And so I would encourage you to think about that, to consider offering more sequence in this area. Maybe you do already, but that combining the academic study with an internship or a practical experience at DHS. So my closing pitch is to consider DHS as a place to work. We have an honors program. It's a great program, and we need talent like yours. We need the best and the brightest to help us solve and help address the emerging threat that we face.
Thank you, Ivan. John?
Thank you, Ivan. I think Ivan's next job might be as the dean of a Homeland Security law program. I want to keep my remarks brief and in part because others have already touched on them, and also to encourage the dialogue among the panel. The name of the I thought the name of the topic for this discussion was interesting, the ever-changing terrorist threat. And I think in talking about an ever-changing terrorist threat, which is an apt description of what we are facing, it leads inevitably to the need for a flexible and nimble legal and policy structure that can respond as the threat changes. I want to reflect a little bit on some of the changes that have occurred since September 11th, talk big picture about where we see the current threat and future threats down the line, but do so while keeping in mind the necessity for the changing threat picture to be mirrored by the government's ability to be equally flexible. Since September 11th, I think there has been a sea change, and I agree with Ivan and Mike, that the U.S. government, in a way that would have been impossible to anticipate, really, as young prosecutors starting out prior to 9/11, really brought all tools to bear, and that means the traditional prosecutor law enforcement tools, diplomacy, the skill sets and authorities of the intelligence community, and the military. And now, in a way that just in part takes the legal and authorities change, but in part takes time for cultural change to occur, there really is a unified across the government effort on the terrorism front to prevent, disrupt, and deter in a way that I'm not sure all could have foreseen. And there have been, as a result, numerous successes and lives saved because of terrorist attacks that, but for these changes, would have occurred. And in that sense, I think what Mike said towards the conclusion of his remarks is true. It would be hard to predict how few lives have been lost since 9/11, when you think about the climate that we were in right after 9/11. Yesterday, the National Security Division had an event commemorating, for those of us in the division, where we were since 9/11. And we heard from the prosecutorial and FBI team that prosecuted the Massawi case. And in listening to it, it really brought you back to that time. And the sense of fear and uncertainty, the shock that it had occurred. In part, they played clips from each of the victims, and they had a visual graphic up of the 3,000 victims, and they talked about how when they were presenting the case in the death penalty phase of the Massawi trial, they really tried and made a conscious decision, no matter the resources, to go out with a prosecutor and FBI agents and treat every single one of those victims as a victim of a homicide and give them the same type of process and discussion that they would if they had gotten each of those cases individually. And it's hard, that still is ringing in my head as I talk to you today and reminds us of why it is that we made these changes, but also that we can't rest on the changes that we've made. We need to continue to analyze the threat, and we need to continue to move and change, and we can't be in a situation again where we make the change after the fact. The threat. I think the core Al-Qaeda remains a capable organization that we treat with all seriousness. And so there's been much talk about the degraded capability, and I won't disagree with that assessment, but from those of us dealing day in and out at the FBI, at the CIA, at the Department of Homeland Security, core Al-Qaeda is still at the front of the mind every day when you're in the morning briefings and hearing the threat picture for that day. The affiliates. What I think we are seeing is a change from where we were more focused, say, 5-6 years ago on long-term core Al-Qaeda plots that were complex along the lines of September 11th. Now we're paying equal attention to affiliate groups like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, or Al-Shabaab, who have declared their allegiance or partnerships with core Al-Qaeda, and other groups who may not have entered into a formal partnership or declared allegiance, but have similar goals or aims and cross-fertilize with some of the core Al-Qaeda groups. The multiplicity of those groups makes our job more complex, although the hopeful advantage is that we've disrupted that long-term complex strategic planning from core Al-Qaeda. The other development that both Mike and Ivan touched on is the growth of homegrown violent extremists. And in part, that's fueled by success in disrupting core Al-Qaeda and causing this multiplicity of actors, but it's also fueled, no doubt, by the internet and the unique role that it now plays in a way that messages that are that take place in a basement overseas in an international setting are reaching our teenagers and our citizens here at home. And if you are inspired, it provides this ability for direct communication that's very difficult to disrupt because it's occurring on the internet. And I think when you look at some of the plots that have either succeeded or we've disrupted, the Fort Hood or disrupted plot to blow up a Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland, several plots to attack military recruitment centers inside the U.S., there's been an unprecedented level over the last couple of years of terrorism disruptions inside the U.S., and a large number of those disruptions are of homegrown violent extremists. And we're seeing the number of people in that category grow, and I would expect, as we're looking ahead at future threats, that's one that will continue to grow, we'll need to continue to monitor, we'll need to continue to come up with new ways to disrupt. And I completely agree with Ivan as to the threat of cyber, and that when it comes to the cyber threat, although there has been significant progress, I know the FBI has started this group, the National Cyber Investigative Joint Task Force, to bring together all the intel and law enforcement and military groups who are operational to focus each time there's an attack on attribution. And with cyber, one of the great difficulties that our legal framework has not kept up with, and we're working to do so, and similarly in our policy framework, is that at the outset of a cyber attack, you don't know who the actor is. And so you really need to blend the resources and figure out, is this the teenage hacker acting in the basement? Is this an organized criminal group? Is this a foreign nation state? Is this a terrorist actor? Is this some type of hybrid, a terrorist group leveraging an organized criminal group or leveraging a group of social hackers? And quickly try to determine after the attack has occurred. And this is more in Ivan's lane, but similarly, we haven't hardened our infrastructure in the cyber arena to a place, I think, where most of us in government would like. And it's an area where the threat will continue to grow. Our reliance on those systems continues to grow, and our ability to respond needs to keep pace. Talk a little bit about structural changes that have occurred since 9/11. I think when it comes to combating the terrorist threat, great strides have been made in part by changing the legal infrastructure. We won't go into long detail about the changes in the Patriot Act and the FAA and FISA, but there has been success at tearing down the wall that existed between law enforcement and intelligence. And I've seen that firsthand both at the FBI and at the Department of Justice, where the old construct that one needed to keep law enforcement investigations separate from intelligence, that was based part on legal interpretation and existing law, but also on policy determination, has really changed. And now the presumption is to share, and the groups are integrated, and law enforcement and disrupting through the criminal justice system is one tool to prevent, disrupt, and deter terrorist attacks. But that's what it is. It's a tool in the arsenal. And the most important thing is the objective of disrupting the attack and sharing the intelligence so that you can bring other tools to bear as well, whether they're diplomatic or military or immigration authorities through DHS. In addition to the legal change, there have been structural changes. The growth of DHS and in the department, in my new position, the National Security Division only came into existence in 2006 as a result of a recommendation, in part as a result of a recommendation from the WMD Commission. And what it was really designed to do is to take advantage of the changes in the law and to place together the prosecutorial experience, so the former counterterrorism and counterintelligence prosecutors that had worked within the Department of Justice, with the intelligence professionals who were not in the criminal division under the old structure of the Department of Justice, put them together in the same division and have the focus be on the goal rather than the authorities that you're using to achieve that goal. And that structural change and other structural changes, like the creation of NCTC and the Department of Homeland Security, they also helped, I think, to accomplish the cultural change where individuals who used to work apart grew used to working together and to bringing the different, and it's important because all of us are operating under the rule of law, but it's a different set of legal authorities and administrative authorities, and you become expert in your way of looking at how to analyze a problem based on the legal authorities that you have and the resources that you can bring to bear. And until these structural changes occurred and then the concomitant changes in the culture, it was difficult to bring those different viewpoints together to solve the problem that we faced, which was preventing the attack. Talk a little bit about outreach, because while you're doing this, many of the terrorist threats for the past 10 years, the violent extremist threats that you're facing, are threats that affect the Muslim and Arab communities inside the United States and other related communities. And so an important part, I think, while this transition was occurring and maintaining the goal of preventing the attack, is doing outreach to these communities. And as part of that, within the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division has brought nearly 800 cases since September 11th against individuals who sought to violate the civil rights of members of the Arab and Muslim communities. It's important to maintain that dialogue and that vigorous enforcement. And in terms of privacy and civil rights, I know it's a mark of pride for the National Security Division at the Department of Justice and for the FBI that the 9/11 Commission, in its findings, one of the reasons they chose or recommended to keep the domestic intelligence function within the Department of Justice was a recognition of the department's longstanding adherence to the rule of law and its record of oversight in that regard. And we bear that as both a mark of pride and also part of our day-to-day responsibilities in executing our authorities and in helping the other members of the intelligence community and our partners exercise their authorities. In short conclusion, although we can reflect and take pride in the progress that we've made, we need to remain focused on the forward threat, and we need to remain critical of the efforts that we're taking in case they need further reform.
Okay, we'll turn to the academics now, and Professor Anderson.
Well, thank you, and I'm delighted to take part in this. I'm going to be very brief, in part because Michael Leiter has already really given the background to much of what it is that I'm focused on here. And second, the other presentations have gone to parts that I'm simply not going to address, particularly the domestic part, the homeland security, these elements. And so with an understanding that this is deliberately a very narrow part of all of this, I'd like to talk for just a minute or two about the question of the use of force outside the United States. So what the role is of the U.S. using force in wars and other kinds of things, but on a outside the United States basis. Now let me start this by going back to something again that Mike Leiter framed, which is, speaking as a business law professor and somebody that teaches corporate finance, there are moments where the right question is framed around what does the additional dollar of spending get me in terms of being able to sell one more unit of iPods, one more iPhone, one more iPad. There are also, similarly, points of which it makes sense to ask, how much does this additional dollar of spending purchase in terms of security or American lives saved or other people's lives saved or any of these questions? And that is, there are moments of which it makes sense to be speaking purely on the margin, that is, a sort of smoothly rising or smoothly falling curves by which an additional unit results in some other additional unit. There are limits to that, however, which is that the nature of many risks is that they are not smooth, they're not continuous, and there isn't any relation between the additional units spent and what you actually gain in the margin. All right. And that has very important bearing on the question of security and the use of force abroad, because most of the use of force abroad is not really about that kind of marginal, we spend one more increment, we get this additional increment of something else. Most of it is actually premised on the idea that it's a huge, huge mistake in terms of the long game that Mike Leiter described to wind up thinking about your activities from a relentlessly tactical, serial standpoint. One of the lessons I took after 9/11 was that the American people were not saying to the leadership, calculate how much additional spending we have in order to save an American life and tell me whether that's greater than the amount that's necessary in order to save them from being struck by lightning. That, I don't think, was the question or the demand or the desire of the American people at that point. It was a strategic expectation that in some way or other the game would be changed in some much more fundamental way. And I believe that the American administrations heard that and went out and pursued the use of force abroad on exactly that kind of expectation. So what was described as two land wars in Asia, plus part of that and also separate from that, a massive counterterrorism effort that, apart from the land wars themselves, are all part of an effort to get beyond the idea of what is, on the one hand, a crucial function of government, to wake up every morning and say, how do I ensure that there is not going to be an attack at the airport? How do I ensure that the plane is not going to come down? How do I ensure all these things on a serial day-by-day-by-day basis? But that cannot win at the strategic level if the expectation is that people don't want to live that way, where that's the primary focus of their lives. And in that regard, then the question becomes, what are the larger strategic elements? And of which I'm only focused on the question of use of force. So I'm leaving aside larger questions of ideology and lots of other things. What I think 10 years on that we have learned from a strategic standpoint is that regime change turns out to be very, very important if you were talking about a regime that, as a regime, winds up harboring non-state terrorist actor groups, Al-Qaeda, and related forces. Regime change in failing states turns out to be marvelously easy because there's not a lot of regime to change. And at that point, then, the question of use of force in a land war becomes, what do you do afterwards? And so, as we've seen in Afghanistan, our effort there became counterinsurgency, on the ground fighting over the very long term. And then a very large strategic question about what do we need to do in order to achieve our overall aim that I think is really to change the nature of the security equation from the standpoint of the United States. We have told ourselves at various points that that requires that we establish democracy, the rule of law, other sorts of institutional changes in Afghanistan. I believe that at some level. I also don't think that it's achievable at another level. And I think that that's the basic strategic encounter that the Obama administration had to deal with as it came in and made its review of America's wars. And I believe that it's reached something like that same conclusion. Desirable things are not always achievable things, and that one has got to separate the question about what would be good in Afghanistan from the question of what is minimally achievable that will be within the U.S. strategic interest as far as counterterrorism goes. Now, at this point, I'm sounding almost exactly like Vice President Biden. And I think that that probably is a fair description of the strategic posture regarding Afghanistan of the Obama administration, and it's one that I think is probably right. Namely, that we're not going to fix Afghanistan much beyond what it is now, that we are going to wind up withdrawing from counterinsurgency, and that we are going to focus on counterterrorism, and that the focus on Afghanistan will become the question of how do we wind up preventing Afghanistan from becoming a safe haven once again for Al-Qaeda or for other groups that might succeed it. And whether that requires a stable government, I think, is probably an open question in the minds of much of the leadership, because I'm not sure that that can actually be achieved. The question then becomes, what happens in Pakistan? And I will set that aside because I don't know the answer, and I don't think that anyone else does either. What we do see, however, is the fragmentation, the proliferation, the movement of groups as they both seek new safe havens in other places. Nigeria is next on the list. So in other words, as they move out further into other places, then the question is what groups should be pursued and in what means. And again, leaving aside all other possibilities, let me end this by saying one thing about use of force. We have decided that the primary tools of our projection of force are going to be at the level of special operations, are going to be at the level of the use of drones, of JSOC, of counterterrorism teams, of CIA, and what we could roughly describe as intelligence-driven uses of force. I believe that that is actually right, given where we are today, and there will be a big question about where those things are used, what the relationship is to other kinds of tools of the projection of national power. Lots of questions like that that I won't attempt to answer. But I do think that we're going to see, at least as far as the use of force, that those are going to be the tools that are the thin tip of the spear. The emphasis there has to be on intelligence-driven, meaning that one has to have the intelligence in order to be able to use the new technological marvels that we are coming up with. One of the things that I think is vastly not understood about the nature of the drone campaign that goes on in Pakistan and in Afghanistan today is the extent to which that depends upon having created over a number of years a genuinely serious intelligence effort on the ground that is able to feed targeting information directly to who is it that you are identifying to target. That's a very long process in which the drone strike is the last kinetic moment of a very, very long intelligence buildup before that. If we're going to wind up using those kinds of uses of force in other places, we're going to have to contemplate the intelligence efforts necessary to make those things work. Let me say one last thing about this, which is I believe that we are, from a legal standpoint, in the position of having to develop new rules at both the domestic level and to integrate them with what our understanding of international law is on the question of what I've here described as intelligence-driven uses of force. I don't think that our legal rules at the domestic level and the way that we've defined covert action and the way that we've defined accountability for it, oversight, reporting, those things, truly fit the picture of what it looks like today, which is not most of the time genuinely covert, but merely deniable. And in a world in which our uses of these kinds of force are really only deniable at a political level for purely fictional purposes, then the discussion of what went on, how we inform about that, the nature of accountability and oversight, I think, has actually got to be reexamined. And then finally, the question of the increasing integration of military and CIA operations in this, I believe, will also require some further re-examination of the legal rules for those things. Dan, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. Steve?
Thanks. So I have the lucky or unfortunate privilege of going last, which means I get the smallest audience, but also the chance to reflect on everybody else. I'm going to try to be brief so we can get to Q&A. I really just have three quick points to make. Well, I hope they're quick. And I'm sort of provoked by something that Michael Leiter said. I think I wrote this down right. I think he said, civil liberties have not been drastically infringed upon over the past decade. And since I'm the crazy lefty up here, I think it's probably worth asking what he meant by civil liberties and whose civil liberties he was referring to. And the reason why I want to start here is because even though our topic today is the changing nature of the terrorist threat, I think it's important to realize that whereas we've spent much of the last hour and a half talking about mistakes that have been made bureaucratically and diplomatically and from a political standpoint and how things have been fixed and improved and institutions rearranged and whole departments stood up from non-existence, there are other mistakes that we've made over the past 10 years. Mistakes that are not about which department is responsible for which action, but mistakes that are about individual civil liberties. And I think as we're considering the changing nature of the terrorist threat, we also have to consider the changing nature of that threat as it relates to individual rights and accountability. And I think that's been what, at least to my mind, we haven't spent a lot of time on so far today. So forgive me, I'm going to spend a few minutes on it. So let me sort of start with the proposition that civil liberties have not been drastically infringed upon over the past decade. So first, I think, of course, that depends on whose civil liberties we're talking about. For non-citizen, let me put it more bluntly. For 20 to 39-year-old Muslim men from who are non-citizens legally in the United States from countries in the Middle East, I think their lives have changed a lot over the last 10 years. I think the odds that they are on various government watch lists, the odds that their neighbors look at them differently, the odds that for various reasons their records are perused more frequently by random private and public officials have all increased. Now, this may be hard to prove. It may not offend most of us, But I think it is still true, and I think it's worth reflecting on that. Second, even if we worry about just we comfortable, you know, middle and upper middle class lawyers, I think there are relevant ways to worry about how that's also changed over the past 10 years. So, for example, before September 11th, it was against the law. There was a federal statute that made it a crime. It was in Title 18 of the United States Code to wiretap an individual without a court order. Right, it was in 18 U.S.C. 2511. You can go look it up. It was also a violation of the Federal Telecommunications Act for telecom providers to provide information about their callers and about their activities to the government without a court order. That was the law, and that is no longer the law thanks to the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. Right, in the process of immunizing the telecom companies for whatever role they played in the wiretapping program, Congress also changed the law going forward so that that would no longer be the case. Two other quick examples, material witness detention. Before September 11th, there was one outlier example of a case where the government had used the federal material witness statute to detain an individual in conjunction with an ongoing grand jury as opposed to petty jury proceeding. Since 9/11, there have been dozens of reported examples. I can only imagine how many unreported examples there have been. And indeed, when a U.S. citizen who was held, in his view, pretextually under the material witness statute, sued to challenge it, the Supreme Court said, no, it's fine because pretext doesn't matter. I think that's a change in the law since what was true before 9/11. Subway searches. I have a hard time believing that before September 11th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit would have had no problem whatsoever saying that random suspicionless searches of passengers entering the New York City subway system does not violate the Fourth Amendment. Now, we all may be okay with the Second Circuit's 2006 holding in Nick Wade versus Kelly that those searches are in fact permissible and they are in fact constitutional. That's fine. My point is just that the law has changed. And so we should actually take seriously the very real ways in which the law has changed as it relates to individual rights. All right, so that's the sort of past. What does this mean going forward, right? How does this relate to a conversation about the changing nature of the terrorist threat? Well, one thought about a body that's in a particularly good position to balance the need for new tools and for new authorities with individual rights is Congress. And I think if we spent a lot of time talking about Congress's track record in this regard over the past decade, it would be a very one-sided conversation. So I mentioned already the FISA Amendments Act. But let's also talk about the actual scope of the war on terrorism, right? Congress, in the Authorization for Use of Military Force, passed on September 18th, actually gave a relatively understandable scope to the conflict it was authorizing. It says the president's authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those persons, organizations, or nations, I think, who were responsible for 9/11, right? There was a tie to 9/11. Now that things are getting a little bit more differentiated, now that we're talking about affiliated groups and co-belligerent groups and even tangentially affiliated groups, there's a hard question about whether they too are encompassed within the original scope. Congress's response is not to hold detailed hearings on how should we think about the AUMF and how should we expand it and what authority does the administration need. Congress's response is to tuck a very, very tiny provision into the National Defense Authorization Act, hold no hearings on it, and then just assume that no one's going to notice that by expanding detention authority to include any group the president says is affiliated with al-Qaeda, it is actually sub silentio extending the scope of the conflict. Right? I mean, I think that's a pretty important thing. Congress relaxing pre-September 11th barriers. Right? It's generally true that the Constitution does not actually provide much in the way of protection when it comes to privacy. In fact, before 9/11, most of the key privacy protections, the laws that prevented businesses from talking to government, were statutory. Right? Congress has relaxed those. Could Congress reinstitute them? Sure. Will they? Well, I leave that to you. The lone wolf provision, right? In the USA Patriot Act in 2001, Congress, at the Bush administration's request, included authority to conduct certain kinds of wiretaps and surveillance on lone wolves, right? So these are terrorism suspects who are not at least clearly affiliated with any particular terrorist organization. This was a critical power, the Bush administration argued. When it expired, the Obama administration also said, this is a really important authority, we really need it. and Congress agreed and re-upped it again. Does anyone know how many times the lone wolf provision has been used since 2001? If it's less than one, you're on your Bill Yeomans. Zero. That's right. Right. So my point is just that if we're going to have this long-term conversation about the changing nature of the terrorist threat, we should also be thinking about the other side of the coin, which is that if we're going to have these new authorities, if we're going to have these new prerogatives, we should also think about whether we should be also designing ways of ensuring accountability. Now, before I sort of shut up and get yelled at by everybody else, let me just say, I don't in any way mean to demean anyone who works on these issues from the executive branch's position. I think it is entirely understandable, and I think it was entirely understandable even during the Bush administration, that executive branch officials will push the envelope, that they will take whatever authority they have and use it to the best of their ability to protect individuals and the country at large, and I think that is right. Right? What we have to appreciate is that that's going to be true. And that even though, as a policy matter, certain administrations may come out looking better, the law still counts. And we still need legal restraints that are going to be enforced not just by the executive branch against themselves. And so as the threat evolves over the next 10 years, since, you know, between now and September 11, 2021, I think we also have to worry about how our statutory protections for civil liberties are also going to evolve. Because otherwise, well, that's a one-way ratchet. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Maybe we ought to start by giving our government officials here an opportunity to respond to Professor Platter.
But not Professor Anderson.
Well, I'll do both.
I'll do both, okay.
So just a comment or two in response, really, on Professor Anderson, not so much on the use of force outside the U.S., but the I think very good and important question you raise about costs and benefits, that additional dollar spent on something that may counter terrorism or some other event versus the benefit that we obtain as a society. That is a question that we think about a lot. We have a duty to be faithful stewards of American taxpayer money. We are accountable to Congress. We are subject to significant oversight by a number of bodies. And so if for nothing else, you know, I think we don't want to be wasting money. We don't want to be cost inefficient. The challenge, and I've actually tried to promote some interdisciplinary conversation here, is that as you framed it, it's difficult to specify or articulate the thing that we are buying. And so let me propose sort of a thought, and unfortunately I'm not an expert in this area, so maybe those of you who are can take this farther. I have consulted with insurance law experts because it seems to me that the analogous area is spending money on insurance. You could argue that that's wasted because you never use, you know, you never get the benefit of it. There's an important distinction, though. You know, insurance kicks in sort of after some negative event occurs, and it doesn't count on what I call sort of prevention costs. And so we all have the hurricane is a great example. You know, how much did you spend to mitigate the potential harm, to fortify whatever your windows or whatever. I mean, all of those costs also we go through in our own minds a bit of a cost benefit, and often we may say, well, after the event, if it didn't happen, you know, that was a waste. But ex ante, you know, really you can't say that. And it's afterwards when there's been some terrible thing and people say, well, you should have spent more, you could have done more, and those are very, in my view, unfair sorts of perspectives, because hindsight is really doesn't take into account the risk that you perceive beforehand. So the thought experiment that I try to invoke in these decisions is we're really spending money to buy down risk. You know, we face a risk landscape, and our job is to evaluate and assess the highest risks. And we should be spending money to in a cost-effective way buy down the highest risks and where it's most cost-effective, that a dollar spent to reduce this risk from 10 units to 2 units is worth a lot more than spending the same dollar to reduce another risk from, you know, maybe 0.3 to 0.299. Yet those comparisons are easy to say in the abstract. In reality, you know, should we spend more to prevent a nuclear WMD incident, a chemical attack, a biological attack, a cyber attack? I mean, those are very difficult, and I challenged our friends at OMB, who also ask these questions, to say that for you economists in the room, you know, there is a Nobel Prize in economics for the person who comes up with a theoretical framework for solving that kind of equation. So I just want to say it is a good question. It is one we struggle with. It is one that I think conceptually we can understand in terms of how we spend our money, but it's very hard ex ante as opposed to ex post to make those assessments. With respect to civil liberties, you know, I, of course, take very seriously, and we do at the department, our mission not only to help secure the homeland, but also to protect the rule of law, privacy, civil rights. And I know you appreciate that there are a lot of people who are doing that. You know, the point about Muslim Americans in the Muslim community, it is a significant effort and subject of outreach because that those relationships are important. I would just distinguish between an impression you may get, which is I don't believe there are the sort of random, suspicionless sort of perusing through files as opposed to intelligence-driven sort of, you know, we have a piece of intelligence about a particular operative who may be traveling to the U.S. On a plane, and, you know, the extent to which we can identify people who fit the specific profile, and then not really do anything other than subject them to greater secondary screening, I think is a way to balance what I think is an important and prudent approach of being risk-driven and intelligence-driven with the sort of broad brush sort of everybody who looks a certain way. I think we are very clear in our guidance and in the training that we give to state and local officials that it's very important not to stereotype or to engage in racial profiling. The wiretap point you make, my familiarity with it actually isn't that that law has gone away, but it's been amended to allow the Attorney General to personally or require a personal certification before certain sharing of information takes place. And so I think the answer isn't so much that it's a black and white prohibition, but that there are procedural safeguards in place. And then the last point I will violently agree with you on the role of Congress. I think it has been in my position now for a little over 2 years. The mainstay of a lot of what I do is deal with Congress, and it is a very difficult situation, particularly given the number some of you may have seen, you know, over 100 congressional committees and subcommittees have oversight jurisdiction over the Department of Homeland Security, and it makes it very difficult, to say the least, to not only be responsive, but to have clear guidance as to what priorities Congress wants. I'll add one more piece, which I think is an important part, which is the third branch. The judiciary has played a significant role. We all know that the law that comes down from court cases tends to lag, and so to some extent courts are playing catch-up, and it makes it very hard when thinking about prevention and trying to lean forward in what we are doing. But the good news, or depending on our perspective, I think the news is that, in general, the government has been very successful in the litigation in which things like the advanced imaging technology at the airports has been challenged on Fourth Amendment grounds, an issue that we have had a bit of discussion with internally is searches of electronic media at the border. So when you bring a laptop in, you get a confluence of, you know, the government's very clear and broad authority to search at the border versus what I think people view as a laptop being very different from a file cabinet. You know, if you were wheeling a big notebook or a file cabinet across the border, there would be no question that the federal government could seize, you know, could without suspicion inspect and seize your file cabinet. But a memory stick or a laptop may be sufficiently different in kind that the courts will come down differently. But that's the kind of question that I think ultimately, you know, the executive branch, Congress, and the courts need to come to some consensus on in order for all of these issues to be sorted out.
John, you want to add anything?
Talk a little bit about resources. So as a law student, you learn so much abstractly about the way the legal framework is based and think less about...
Sorry about that. But as a law student, you tend to think abstractly about the legal framework and less about what goes into the day-to-day decision-making. I know for my time when I was at the FBI, it was a shock at how limited the resources were. And when you think about the entire budget of the FBI, the yearly budget is somewhere in the order of $8 billion. The total employees of the organization is roughly 30,000. That's a big growth since 9/11. But when you consider the size of the United States, and then the number of FBI agents is roughly in the order of 14,000. So it doesn't compare that well in some ways to large municipal police departments when you consider the scope of the responsibilities, not just in the counterterrorism or foreign intelligence realm, but civil rights and public corruption, violent crime and gangs, drug offenses, bank robberies. The scope of activity where the American public turns to the FBI and expects a solution is enormous compared to the resources. So what does that do day to day? That means every day that you make a decision or an agent makes a decision on a particular case, or now that it's intel-driven, that you analyze the threats in a particular domain or area of the United States, you have to decide, where am I going to apply those extraordinarily scarce resources given the scope of the population and the threats that we face. And in that sense, the resource constraints, there's a happy marriage between the resource constraints and those of us looking at the civil rights and civil liberties concerns, because in response to one remark of the professor, it would be a terrible use of those resources to randomly check large communities or attempt to randomly look at a U.S. person. Even if you were allowed to do it and you had the legal structure in place and authorities, which you do not, it would be a terrible use of resources. And instead, I think the day-to-day challenge is the opposite. It's how do we triage the articulable threats that we're receiving day in and day out and decide of this vast volume of threats, or the threat matrix of terrible acts that we're hearing chatter about, which one of these are the ones that are most likely to become operational and where we should apply our scarce resources. And that, you know, is a decision that's extraordinarily difficult to get right, and is one that I think has been key and really the cornerstone of the FBI's transformation over the last 10 years, which is we have these intelligence analysts, we share the intelligence, we receive the intelligence. Now, how do we make those decisions on the application of resources to disrupt? And it goes to the risk analysis that Ivan was discussing. Just on one, the lone wolf provision, it's one that has garnered a lot of attention, perhaps because of the name. It's It's ironic to me a little bit that it's used as an example of violation of civil rights and civil liberties, since, as the professor stated, it's never been used. And so in that sense, we can all breathe a sigh of relief that you have not been targeted. But it is an authority that, if it were used, it really goes to whether or not you could plead out that an individual was linked to a particular identifiable terrorist group. And so the concern is you'll have an incident where you can make the showing, and it does require a showing to Article III judges in a court, in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, that you could make the showing that an individual falls within your foreign intelligence authorities, but you couldn't show that they were linked to a particular group. It's called the Misawi problem. And thankfully, it's not one that's been confronted, but the thought was good to have the authority. If we did use it, it's one where it also goes from the FBI to the National Security Division. The application would have to be approved. It then goes to the court. The court would have to approve it, and then after it was used, you'd have to report its use back to Congress. So I think there are areas where it would be receiving additional guidance or clarity from Congress would be appreciated. I'm not sure if Lone Wolf is, although it's important, I think, to plan for that possible eventuality, is I think it's probably received too much attention.
Although, I mean, in that sense, right, I mean, it might just be that it's a metaphor, right, and that the metaphor is, I mean, this is actually the point I was trying to make, and I think both of your responses helpfully illustrates it, which is that from the perspective of the executive branch, the position rightly is we haven't used these authorities, and therefore there's nothing to worry about, right? We have been faithful. We have not crossed these lines. We're not doing random stuff because of resource constraints or other reasons. And from my, you know, crazy academics perspective, that's wonderful, but it's a political constraint, not a legal one, right? It's a constraint that is only as good as the circumstances that allow it to exist. And, you know, as the threat evolves over time and as things change and as there are new crises, the fact that these authorities are out there, whether or not they've been used, is what gives me pause and is what I think we should be addressing. It's, you know, to paraphrase Justice Jackson, it's the loaded weapon. And, you know, responsible executive branch officers will only shoot the loaded weapon when they have to. But my concern is about making sure we understand when the weapon is, you know, there.
I could also, just a reply to I can't help myself.
So reply.
I think you may underestimate the power of the statement by the senior, you know, legal officials in a department that something is unlawful. So if your point is that, you know, do we prosecute people or do we not indemnify them when they cross the line, you know, that I will leave to others. But I can tell you from personal experience that I wouldn't even call it pressure. I think there is a sense of shared mission that people come to these agencies because they are dedicated to the mission. When I do recruiting or when I meet the lawyers, I often ask them, you know, why did you come to work for DHS? And I shouldn't be surprised, but at least in the beginning, I was very surprised that a very common answer, maybe in more than half the occasions, people would say, 9/11 affected me in ways that I can't describe, and I resolved to myself that I wanted to do something about it, and I'm a lawyer, and so I applied for a job at DHS, and here I am. And every day when we respond to various crises and people work late into the evening, overnight, over the weekends to respond to hurricanes, earthquakes, I mean, I see that every day. And the point is really not that you know, we're so blinded by the mission that we ignore the rule of law, but that people do take seriously, and I can't go into the internal deliberations, but there are many, it is the rule, not the exception, that the lawyers will say, I'm sorry, you're about to cross the line, or if you were to go there, it would raise significant litigation risk. And if we explain to them what that risk is and why, we will help them find a much better path to get to accomplish what they want to do. So you may call it political. I view it as the shadow of the law. I mean, this is what happens every day in the executive branch, where lawyers are giving advice and people who are policymakers or operators actually follow the advice. It's the very rare occasion, and those sometimes you do hear about when people go above, behind or beside the lawyers, and they're the ones who get in trouble, and we are very fond of pointing that out to people.
So we're going to have the Libya conversation next week, right?
Well, the problem sometimes, of course, is that the legal advice, as we saw arguably in some years ago with respect to torture, may not have been the correct advice. But I agree with Ivan that there is a great effort to preserve the rule of law within the executive branch, but of course the legal advice has to be the right advice. We've run out of time. I would like anyone should feel free to leave
do you have to leave?
About 5 minutes. All right. I would like to give an opportunity for people to ask questions if we have some questions, and I sure have a couple. Yeah. Kate? Who wants to take that on?
In terms of the threat posed by homegrown violent extremists and how seriously it should be taken by the FBI, Department of Justice, and Department of Homeland Security. I do think this is an area where you look to the executive branch is accountable ultimately to the people. And we listen carefully to our oversight from the Hill. And I throw it back a little bit on what are the expectations and what is the ask. So currently, I think it's very clear that the number one priority of the FBI is to prevent terrorist attacks, regardless of the perpetrator, inside the United States. That is also the number one priority of the Department of Justice. Clearly, and that includes both international terrorists and domestic terrorists, and it certainly includes homegrown violent extremists. I think many of us remember Oklahoma City and the type of damage that became caused in that case by a violent extremist who was a domestic terrorist. And so, and I think if we've seen some of the public response to a couple of events over the past 2 years, the tragic loss of life at Fort Hood and the failed attempt to blow up an airliner by Abdul Muttalib, and the reaction and response that that we received in my former seat at the FBI indicated expectations were high, that it was unacceptable that it to become that near to a success in the case of Abdul Muttalib. I think similarly in similar criticism in Times Square. And with Fort Hood, that it was unacceptable that any attack had occurred at all. There was a extensive investigation by multiple congressional committees. There was a White House-driven interagency extensive investigation as to what had got wrong and what could be fixed. And the message was clear that although it may be impossible to assure 100% safety from a terrorist attack, that is and should remain our goal, and that every day we should be doing everything we can within our existing authorities, ever mindful of our obligation to the rule of law and civil liberties to prevent those attacks from occurring. And it is not up, I don't think, to the it's important, I think, for the executive branch agencies such as FBI and Department of Justice and DHS to attempt to execute according to your authorities and the expectation until told otherwise. And so that will remain our number one goal. I won't give my personal opinion as to whether we should attempt to stop homegrown violent extremists from committing terrorist attacks inside the United States, ranging from shooting up pedestrian malls or along the lines of what we saw in Mumbai, or using improvised explosive devices. But I will say that currently that's our goal and our drive each day is to prevent that from occurring. And I certainly don't think that's outside the bounds of what we should be doing.
You want to add anything quickly, Ivan?
I wanted to mention or respond to this point about countering violent extremism and this distinction between homegrown and foreign. I think those concepts are elusive. I think there is are important differences, to be sure, but we are increasingly seeing a evolution of the threat so that the border actually is making less of a difference. And I think John alluded to the frequency with which we see the internet being a medium for communication, and that the transnational nature of some of the operations. So I would hesitate to say that they're completely different, nor am I saying that they're identical. I think they share some similarities, and that I think it's important to treat it as a spectrum as opposed to two distinct categories. I also want to say that the increase in authorities I think does result from the evolving threat, that as the threat evolves, as the landscape changes, the folks who are tasked every day to prevent and to deter need to have different authorities. And we engage in that very public debate, for example, in the cybersecurity arena, where because of the evolving threat, I think you have seen both the administration and others propose legislation to clarify some of the authorities. the last point to respond to this very important question that's been a bit of a theme, has it been worth it? I saw a statistic the other day. The DHS budget is about 3.5% of the overall federal budget. And I leave it to you to decide whether that's too much, too little, you know, enough, not enough. But I think we sometimes have this impression that we are spending an inordinate amount of money, and we are spending a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but we are also spending money in lots of other very important priorities that this country has. And to me, I'll interject my own personal view, I mean, 3.5% doesn't strike me as being unduly high.
Okay, I think, while I know there are more questions and I have some questions, I think we really have run out of time and people have to leave. So I'm going to call it quits and thank you.